Chapter 23. Reprogramming. We have not followed cunningly devised fables, but were eyewitnesses. 2 Peter 1:16. Look and remember. Look upon this sky. Look deep and deep into the sea clean air, the unconfined, the terminus of prayer. Speak now and speak into the hallowed dome. What do you hear? What does the sky reply? The heavens are taken. This is not your home. From Carl J. Shapiro's Travelogue for Exiles. The telephone lines had been repaired, the roads ploughed clean, and carefully selected representatives of the world's press were given a brief look at the facility. A few reporters and photographers were taken through the three matching apertures in the Benzels, through the airlock and into the dodec. There were television commentaries recorded, the reporters seated in the chairs that the five had occupied, telling the world of the failure of this first courageous attempt to activate the machine. Ellie and her colleagues were photographed from a distance to show that they were alive and well, but no interviews were to be given just yet. The machine project was taking stock and considering its future options. The tunnel from Honshu to Hokkaido was open again, but the passageway from Earth to Vega was closed. They hadn't actually tested this proposition. Ellie wondered whether, when the five finally left the site, the project would try to spin up the Benzels again. But she believed what she'd been told. The machine would not work again. There would be no further access to the tunnels for the beings of Earth. We could make little indentations in space-time as much as we liked. It would do us no good, if no one hooked up from the other side. We had been given a glimpse, she thought, and then were left to save ourselves, if we could. In the end, the five were permitted to talk among themselves. She systematically bade farewell to each. No one blamed her for the blank cassettes. These pictures on the cassettes are recorded in magnetic domains, on tape, Vega reminded her. A strong electrical field accumulated on the Benzels, and they were, of course, moving. A time-varying electrical field makes a magnetic field. It's Maxwell's equations. It seems to me that's how your tapes were erased. It was not your fault. Vega's interrogation had baffled him. They had not exactly accused him, but merely suggested that he was part of an anti-Soviet conspiracy involving scientists from the West. I tell you, Ellie, the only remaining open question is the existence of intelligent life in the Politburo. And the White House, she replied. I can't believe the president would allow kids to get away with this. She committed herself to the project. The planet is run by crazy people, said Vega. Remember what they have to do to get where they are. Their perspective is so narrow, so brief. A few years? In the best of them, a few decades. They care only about the time they are in power. She thought about Cygnus A. But they're not sure our story is a lie. They cannot prove it. Therefore, we must convince them. In their hearts, they wonder, could it be true? A few of them even want it to be true, but it is a risky truth. They need something close to certainty. And perhaps we can provide it. We can refine gravitational theory. We can make new astronomical observations to confirm what we were told, especially for the galactic center and Cygnus A. They're not going to stop astronomical research. Also, we can study the dodec if they give us access. We will change their minds. But difficult to do, if they're all crazy, she thought to herself. I don't see how the governments could convince people that this is a hoax, she said.
Really? Think of what else they made people believe. They persuaded us that we'll be safe if only we spend all our wealth, so everybody on Earth can be killed in a moment, when the governments decide the time has come. I would think it's hard to make people believe something so foolish. No, Ellie. They're good at convincing. They need only say that the machine doesn't work and that we've gone a little mad.
I don't think we'd seem so mad if we all told our story together, but you may be right, she said. Maybe we should try to find some evidence first. Vege, will you be okay when you go back?
What can they do to me? Exile me to Gorky? I could survive that. I've had my day at the beach. No, I will be safe. You and I have a mutual security treaty, Ellie. As long as you're alive, they need me. And vice versa, of course. If the story is true, they will be glad there was a Soviet witness. Eventually, they will cry it from the rooftops. And, like your people, they will wonder about military and economic uses of what we saw. It doesn't matter what they tell us to do. All that matters is that we stay alive. Then we will tell our story, all five of us, discreetly, of course. At first, only to those we trust. But those people will tell others. The story will spread. There will be no way to stop it. Sooner or later, the governments will acknowledge what happened to us in the dodecahedron. And until then, we are insurance policies for each other. Ellie, I'm very happy about all this. It is the greatest thing that ever happened to me.
Give Nina a kiss for me, she said, just before he left on the night flight to Moscow. Over breakfast, she asked if he was disappointed. Disappointed? To go there? He lifted his eyes skyward. To see them and to be disappointed? I am an orphan of the Long March. I survived the Cultural Revolution. I was trying to grow potatoes and sugar beets for 6 years in the shadow of the Great Wall. Upheaval has been my whole life. I know disappointment. You have been to a banquet, and when you come home to your starving village, you are disappointed that they do not celebrate your return. This is no disappointment. We have lost a minor skirmish. Examine the disposition of forces. He would shortly be departing for China, where he had agreed to make no public statements about what had happened in the machine. But he would return to supervise the dig at Qian. The tomb of Qin was waiting for him. He wanted to see how closely the Emperor resembled that simulation on the far side of the tunnels. Forgive me, I know that this is impertinent, said Ellie after a while, but the fact that all of us, you alone met someone who... Well, what I mean is, in all your life, wasn't there anyone you loved? She wished she'd phrased the question better. Everyone I ever loved was taken from me, obliterated. I saw the emperors of the 20th century come and go, he answered. I longed for someone who could not be revised or rehabilitated or edited out. There are only a few historical figures who cannot be erased. He was looking at the tabletop, fingering the teaspoon. I devoted my life to the revolution, and I have no regrets. But I know almost nothing of my mother and father. I have no memories of them. Your mother is still alive. You remember your father, and you found him again. Do not overlook how fortunate you are. In Divai, Ellie sensed a grief that she had never before noticed. She assumed it was a reaction to the skepticism with which Project Directorate and the governments had greeted their story, but Divai shook her head. Whether they believe us is not very important for me, she said. The experience itself is central, transforming. Ellie, that really happened to us. It was real. The first night we were back here on Hokkaido, I dreamt that our experience was a dream, you know, but it wasn't. Oh, it wasn't. Yes, I am sad. My sadness is Well, you know, I satisfied a lifelong wish up there when I found Surinder again. After all these years, he was exactly as I remembered him, exactly as I have dreamed of him. But when I saw him, when I saw so perfect a simulation, I knew. This love was precious because it had been snatched away. Because I had given up so much to marry him, nothing more. The man was a fool. 10 years with him, and we would have been divorced. Maybe only 5. I was so young and foolish. Oh, I'm truly sorry, Ellie said. I know a little about mourning a lost love. Ellie, she replied, you don't understand. For the first time in my adult life, I do not mourn Surinder. What I mourn is the family I renounced for his sake. Sakavati was returning to Bombay for a few days and then would visit her ancestral village in Tamil Nadu. Eventually, she said, it will be easy to convince ourselves that this was only an illusion. Every morning when we wake up, our experience will be more distant, more dreamlike. It would have been better for us all to stay together to reinforce our memories. They understood this danger. That's why they took us to the seashore, something like our own planet, a reality we can grasp. I will not permit anyone to trivialize this experience. Remember, it really happened. It was not a dream, Ellie. Don't forget. Edda was, considering the circumstances, very relaxed. She soon understood why. While she and Vege had been undergoing lengthy interrogations, he had been calculating. I think the tunnels are Einstein-Rosen bridges, he said. General relativity admits a class of solutions called wormholes, similar to black holes, but with no evolutionary connection. They cannot be generated, as black holes can, by the gravitational collapse of a star, but the usual sort of wormhole, once made, expands and contracts before anything can cross through. It exerts disastrous tidal forces, and it also requires, at least as seen by an observer left behind, an infinite amount of time to get through. Ellie did not see how this represented much progress. She asked him to clarify. The key problem, apparently, was holding the wormhole open. Edda had found a class of solutions to his field equations that suggested a new macroscopic field, a kind of tension that could be used to prevent a wormhole from contracting fully. Such a wormhole would pose none of the other problems of black holes. It would have much smaller tidal stresses, two-way access, quick transit times as measured by an exterior observer, and no devastating interior radiation field. I don't know whether the tunnel is stable against small perturbations, he said. If not, they would have to build a very elaborate feedback system to monitor and correct the instabilities. I'm not yet sure of any of this. But at least if the tunnels can be Einstein-Rosen bridges, we can give some answer when they tell us that we were hallucinating. Edda was eager to return to Lagos, and she could see the green ticket of Nigerian Airlines peeking out of his jacket pocket. He wondered if he could completely work through the new physics that their experience had implied, but he confessed himself unsure that he would be equal to the task, especially because of what he described as his advanced age for theoretical physics. He was 38. Most of all, he told Ellie, he was desperate to be reunited with his wife and children. She embraced Edda. She told him that she was proud to have known him. Why the past tense? He asked. You will certainly see me again. And Ellie, he added, almost as an afterthought, will you do something for me? Remember everything that happened, every detail. Write it down and send it to me. Our experience represents experimental data. One of us may have seen some point that the others missed. something essential for a deep understanding of what happened. Send me what you write. I have asked the others to do the same. He waved, lifted his battered briefcase, and was ushered into the waiting project car. They were departing for their separate nations, and it felt to Ellie as if her own family were being sundered, broken, dispersed. She, too, had found the experience transforming. How could she not? A demon had been exorcised. Several. And just when she felt more capable of love than she'd ever been, she found herself alone. They spirited her out of the facility by helicopter. On the long flight to Washington in the government airplane, she slept so soundly that they had to shake her awake when the White House people came aboard, just after the aircraft landed briefly on an isolated runway at Hickam Field, Hawaii. They had made a bargain. She could go back to Argus, although no longer as director, and pursue any scientific problem she pleased. She had, if she liked, lifetime tenure. "We're not unreasonable," Kitts had finally said in agreeing to the compromise. "You come back with a solid piece of evidence, something really convincing, and we'll join you in making the announcement. We'll say we asked you to keep the story quiet until we could be absolutely sure. Within reason, we'll support any research you want to do. If we announce the story now, though, there'll be an initial wave of enthusiasm, and then the skeptics will start carping. It'll embarrass you, and it'll embarrass us. It's much better to gather the evidence, if you can." Perhaps the president had helped him change his mind. It was unlikely that Kitts was enjoying the compromise. But in return, she must say nothing about what had happened aboard the machine. The five had sat down in the dodecahedron, talked among themselves, and then walked off. If she breathed a word of anything else, the spurious psychiatric profile would find its way to the media, and reluctantly she would be dismissed. She wondered whether they had attempted to buy Peter Valerian's silence, or Vagues, or Abenabers. She couldn't see how, short of shooting the debriefing teams of five nations and the World Machine Consortium, they could hope to keep this quiet forever. It was only a matter of time. So, she concluded, they were buying time. It surprised her how mild the threatened punishments were, but violations of the agreement, if they happened, would not come on Kitz's watch. He was shortly retiring, in a year. The Lasker administration would be leaving office after the constitutionally mandated maximum of 2 terms. He had accepted a partnership in a Washington law firm known for its defense contractor clientele. Ellie thought Kitts would attempt something more. He seemed unworried about anything she might claim occurred at the Galactic Center. What he agonized about, she was sure, was the possibility that the tunnel was still open to, even if not from, the Earth. She thought that the Hokkaido facility would soon be disassembled. The technicians would return to their industries and universities. What stories would they tell? Perhaps the dodecahedron would be displayed in the science city of Tsukuba. Then, after a decent interval when the world's attention was to some extent distracted by other matters, perhaps there would be an explosion at the machine site. Nuclear, if Kitts could contrive a plausible explanation for the event. If it was a nuclear explosion, the radiological contamination would be an excellent reason to declare the whole area a forbidden zone. It would at least isolate the site from casual observers and might just shake the nozzle loose. Probably Japanese sensibilities about nuclear weapons, even if exploded underground, would force Kitts to settle for conventional explosives. They might disguise it as one of the continuing series of Hikkōdō coal mine disasters. She doubted if any explosion, nuclear or conventional, could disengage the Earth from the tunnel. But perhaps Kitts was imagining none of these things, she thought. Perhaps she was selling him short. After all, he too must have been influenced by Matindo. He must have a family, friends,
someone he loved. He must have caught at least a whiff of it. The next day, the president awarded her the National Medal of Freedom in a public ceremony at the White House. Logs were burning in a fireplace set in a white marble wall. The president had committed a great deal of political, as well as the more usual sort of capital, to the machine project, and was determined to make the best face of it before the nation and the world. Investments in the machine by the United States and other nations, the argument went, had paid off handsomely. New technologies, new industries were blossoming, promising at least as much benefit for ordinary people as the inventions of Thomas Edison. We had discovered that we are not alone, that intelligences more advanced than we existed out there in space. They had changed forever, the president said, our conception of who we are. Speaking for herself, but also, she thought, for most Americans, the discovery had strengthened her belief in God, now revealed to be creating life and intelligence on many worlds, a conclusion that the president was sure would be in harmony with all religions. But the greatest good granted us by the machine, the president said, was the spirit it had brought to Earth, the increasing mutual understanding within the human community, the sense that we were all fellow passengers on a perilous journey in space and in time, the goal of a global unity of purpose that was now known all over the planet as Machindo. The president presented Ellie to the press and the television cameras, told of her perseverance over 12 long years, her genius in detecting and decoding the message, and her courage in going aboard the machine. No one knew what the machine would do. Dr. Arroway had willingly risked her life. It was not Dr. Arroway's fault that nothing happened when the machine was activated. She had done as much as any human possibly could. She deserved the thanks of all Americans and of all people everywhere on Earth. Ellie was a very private person. Despite her natural reticence, she had, when the need arose, shouldered the burden of explaining the message and the machine. Indeed, she had shown a patience with the press that she, the president's, admired particularly. Dr. Arroway should now be permitted some real privacy, so that she could resume her scientific career. There had been press announcements, briefings, interviews with Secretary Kitts and science advisor Dehier. The president hoped that the press would respect Dr. Arroway's wish that there be no press conference. There was, however, a photo opportunity. Ellie left Washington without determining how much the president knew. They flew her back in a small, sleek jet of the Joint Military Airlift Command and agreed to stop in Janesville on the way. Her mother was wearing her old quilted robe. Someone had put a little color on her cheeks. Ellie pressed her face into the pillow beside her mother. Beyond regaining a halting power of speech, the old woman had recovered the use of her right arm, sufficiently to give Ellie a few feeble pats on her shoulder. "Mom, I've got something to tell you. It's a great thing, but try to be calm. I don't want to upset you, Mom. I saw Dad. I saw him. He sends you his love." "Yes," the old woman slowly nodded. "He was here yesterday." John Stoughton, Ellie knew, had been to the nursing home the previous day. He had begged off accompanying Ellie today, pleading an excess of work, but it seemed possible that Stoughton merely did not wish to intrude on this moment. Nevertheless, she found herself saying with some irritation, "No, no, no, I'm talking about Dad." "Tell him," the old woman's speech was labored, "tell him chiffon dress, stop at cleaners, way home from the store." Her father evidently still ran the hardware store in her mother's universe, and Ellie's. The long sweep of cyclone fencing now stretched
uselessly from horizon to horizon, blighting the expanse of scrub desert. She was glad to be back, glad to be setting up a new, although much smaller scale, research program. Jack Hibbert had been appointed acting director of the Argus facility, and she felt unburdened of the administrative responsibilities. Because so much telescope time had been freed when the signal from Vega had ceased, there was a heady air of progress in a dozen long-languishing sub-disciplines of radio astronomy. Her co-workers offered not a hint of support for Kitz's notion of a message hoax. She wondered what De Heer and Valerian were telling their friends and colleagues about the message and the machine. Ellie doubted that Kitz had breathed a word of it outside the recesses of his soon-to-be-vacated Pentagon office. She had been there once. A Navy enlisted man, sidearm in leather holster and hands clasped behind his back, had stiffly guarded the portal. In case, in the warren of concentric hallways, some passerby should succumb to an irrational impulse. Willie had himself driven the Thunderbird from Wyoming, so it would be waiting for her. By agreement, she could drive it only on the facility, which was large enough for ordinary joyriding, but no more West Texas landscapes, no more Coney honor guards, no more mountain drives to glimpse a southern star. This was her sole regret about the seclusion. But the ranks of saluting rabbits were, at any rate, unavailable in winter. At first, a sizable press corps haunted the area in hopes of shouting a question at her or photographing her through a telescopic lens, but she remained resolutely isolated. The newly imported public relations staff was effective, even a little ruthless in discouraging inquiries. After all, the president had asked for privacy for Dr. Arroway. Over the following weeks and months, the battalion of reporters dwindled to a company and then to a platoon. Now only a squad of the most steadfast remained, mostly from the World Hologram and other sensationalist weekly newspapers, the Kilius magazines, and a lone representative from a publication that called itself Science and God. No one knew what sect it belonged to, and its reporter wasn't telling. When the stories were written, they told of 12 years of dedicated work, culminating in the momentous, triumphant decryption of the message, and followed by the construction of the machine. At the peak of world expectation, it had sadly failed. The machine had gone nowhere. Naturally, Dr. Arroway was disappointed. Maybe, they speculated, even a little depressed. Many editorialists commented that this pause was welcome. The pace of new discovery and the evident need for major philosophical and religious reassessments represented so heady a mix that a time of retrenchment and slow reappraisal was needed. Perhaps the Earth was not yet ready for contact with alien civilizations. Sociologists and some educators claimed that the mere existence of extraterrestrial intelligences more advanced than we would require several generations to be properly assimilated. It was a body blow to human self-esteem, they said. There was enough on our plate already. In another few decades, we would much better understand the principles underlying the machine. We would see what mistakes we had made, and we would laugh at how trivial an oversight had prevented it from functioning in its first full trial back in 1999. Some religious commentators argued that the failure of the machine was a punishment for the sin of pride, for human arrogance. Billy Joe Rankin, in a nationwide television address, proposed that the message had in fact come straight from a hell called Vega, an authoritative consolidation of his previous positions on the matter. The message and the machine, he said, were a latter-day Tower of Babel. Humans foolishly, tragically, had aspired to reach the throne of God. There had been a city of fornication and blasphemy built thousands of years ago called Babylon, which God had destroyed. In our time there was another such city with the same name. Those dedicated to the Word of God had fulfilled his purpose there as well. The message and the machine represented still another assault of wickedness upon the righteous and the God-fearing. Here again the demonic inactivity had been forestalled. In Wyoming, by a divinely inspired accident, and in godless Russia, through the confounding of communist scientists by the divine grace. But despite these clear warnings of God's will, Rankin continued, humans had for a third time tried to build the machine. God let them. Then, gently, subtly, he caused the machine to fail, deflected the demonic intent, and once more demonstrated his care and concern for his wayward and sinful, if truth be told, his unworthy children on earth. It was time to learn the lessons of our sinfulness, our abominations, and before the coming millennium, the real millennium that would begin on January the 1st, 2001, rededicate our planet and ourselves to God. The machines should be destroyed. Every last one of them and all their parts. The pretense that by building a machine, rather than by purifying their hearts, humans could stand at the right hand of God, must be expunged, root and branch, before it was too late. In her little apartment, Ellie heard Rankin out, turned off the television set, and resumed her programming. The only outside calls she was permitted were to the rest home in Janesville, Wisconsin. All incoming calls, except from Janesville, were screened out. Polite apologies were provided, letters from Dehir, Valerian, from her old college friend, Becky Ellenbogen. She filed unopened. There were a number of messages delivered by express mail services and then by courier from South Carolina, from Palmer Joss. She was much more tempted to read these, but she did not. She wrote him a note that read only, "Dear Palmer, not yet, Ellie," and posted it with no return address. She had no way of knowing if it would be delivered. A television special on her life, made without her consent, described her as more reclusive now than Neil Armstrong or even Greta Garbo. Ellie took it all with cheerful equanimity. She was otherwise occupied. Indeed, she was working night and day. The prohibitions on communication with the outside world did not extend to purely scientific collaboration, and through open-channel asynchronous telenetting, she and Vega organized a long-term research program. Among the objects to be examined were the vicinity of Sagittarius A at the center of the galaxy and the great extragalactic radio source, Cygnus A. The Argus telescopes were employed as part of a phased array linked with the Soviet telescopes in Samarkand. Together, the American-Soviet array acted as if they were part of a single radio telescope the size of the Earth. Operating at a wavelength of a few centimeters, they could resolve sources of radio emission as small as the inner solar system if they were as far away as the center of the galaxy. She worried that this was not good enough, that the two orbiting black holes were considerably smaller than that. Still, a continuous monitoring program might turn up something. What they really needed, she thought, was a radio telescope launched by space vehicle to the other side of the sun and working in tandem with radio telescopes on Earth. Humans could thereby create a telescope effectively the size of the Earth's orbit. With it, she calculated, they could resolve something the size of the Earth at the center of the galaxy, or maybe the size of the station. She spent most of her time writing, modifying existing programs for the Cray-21, and setting down an account, as detailed as she possibly could make it, of the salient events that had been squeezed into the 20 minutes of Earth time after they activated the machine. Halfway through, she realized she was writing Samizdat, typewriter and carbon paper technology. She locked the original and two copies in her safe, beside a yellowing copy of the Haddon decision, secreted the third copy behind a loose plank in the electronics bay of Telescope 49 and burned the carbon paper. It generated a black, acrid smoke. In 6 weeks, she had finished reprogramming, and just as her thoughts returned to Palmer Joss, he presented himself at the Argus front gate. His way had been cleared by a few phone calls from a special assistant to the president, with whom, of course, Joss had been acquainted for years. Even here in the Southwest, with its casual sartorial codes, he wore, as always, a jacket, a white shirt, and a tie. She gave him the palm frond, thanked him for the pendant, and, despite all of Kitz's admonitions to keep her delusional experience quiet, she immediately told him everything. They adopted the practice of her Soviet colleagues, who, whenever anything politically unorthodox needed to be said, discovered the urgent necessity for a brisk walk. Every now and then he would stop, and a distant observer would see lean toward her. Each time she would take his arm, and they would walk on. He listened sympathetically, intelligently, indeed generously, especially for someone whose doctrines must, she thought, be challenged at their fundaments by her account, if he gave them any credence at all. After all his reluctance at the time the message had first been received, at last she was showing Argus to him. He was companionable, and she found herself happy to see him. She wished she'd been less preoccupied when she had seen him last in Washington. Apparently at random, they climbed up the narrow metal exterior stairways that straddled the base of Telescope 49. The vista of 130 radio telescopes, most of them rolling stock on their own set of railway tracks, was like nothing else on Earth. In the electronics bay, she slid back the plank and retrieved a bulky envelope with Joss's name upon it. He put it in his inside breast pocket, where it made a discernible bulge. She told him about the SAG-A and SIG-A observing protocols. She told him about her computer program. It's very time-consuming, even with the Cray, to calculate pi out to something like 10 to the 20th place, and we don't know that what we're looking for is in pi. They sort of said it wasn't. It might be E. It might be one of the family of transcendental numbers that they told Vague A about it. It might be some altogether different number. So a simple-minded brute force approach, I mean just calculating fashionable transcendental numbers forever, is a waste of time. But here at Argos we have very sophisticated decryption algorithms designed to find patterns in a signal, designed to pull out and display anything that looks non-random. So I rewrote the programs. From the expression on Joss's face, Ellie was afraid that she'd not been clear. She made a small swerve in the monologue. I rewrote not to calculate the digits in a number like pi, print them out and present them for inspection. There isn't enough time for that. Instead, the program now races through the digits in pi and pauses, even to think about it, only when there's some anomalous sequence of zeros and ones. Now, you know what I'm saying? Something non-random. By chance, there'll be some zeros and ones. Of course, 10% of the digits will be zeros, and another 10% will be ones, on average. The more digits we race through, the longer the sequences of pure zeros and ones that we should get by accident. The program knows what's expected statistically and only pays attention to unexpectedly long sequences of zeros and ones. And it doesn't only look in base 10. Joss said, I don't understand. If you look at enough random numbers, won't you get any pattern you want simply by chance? Oh, sure, but you can calculate how likely that is. If you get a very complex message very early on, you know it can't be by chance. So, every day in the early hours of the morning, the computer works on this problem. No data from the outside world goes in, and so far, no data from the inside world comes out. It just runs through the optimum series expansion for pi and watches the digits fly. It minds its own business. Unless it finds something, it doesn't speak, unless it's spoken to. It's sort of contemplating its navel. I'm no mathematician, God knows, said Joss, but could you give me a for instance? Sure. She searched in the pockets of her jumpsuit for a piece of paper and could find none. She thought about reaching into his inside breast pocket, retrieving the envelope she'd just given him, and writing on that, but decided that was too risky out here in the open. After a moment, he understood and produced a small spiral notebook. "Thanks. Now, look, pi starts out at 3.1415926. Now, you can see that the digits vary pretty randomly. Okay, a 1 appears twice in the first 4 digits, but after you keep on going for a while, it averages out. Each digit, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, appears almost exactly 10% of the time, when you've accumulated enough digits. Now, occasionally, you'll get a few consecutive digits that are the same, 4, 4, 4, 4, for example, but, well, not more than you'd expect statistically. Now, suppose you're running merrily through these digits and suddenly you find nothing but fours, hundreds of fours, all in a row. That couldn't carry any information, but it also couldn't be a statistical fluke. You could calculate the digits in pi for the age of the universe, and if the digits are random, you'd never go deep enough to get 100 consecutive fours. "It's like the search you did for the message," he said, "with those radio telescopes." "Yes. In both cases, we were looking for a signal that's well out of the noise, something that can't be just a statistical fluke." "But it doesn't have to be 100 fours," he said. "Is that right? I mean, it could speak to us." "Oh, sure. Now imagine after a while we get a long sequence of just zeros and ones. Then, just as we did with a message, we could pull a picture out, if there's one in there. You understand? It could be anything." "You mean you could decode a picture hiding in pi and it would be a mess of Hebrew letters?" "Oh, sure. Big black letters carved in stone." He looked at her quizzically. "Oh, forgive me, Eleanor, but don't you think you're being a mite too indirect? You don't belong to a silent order of Buddhist nuns. Now, why don't you just tell your story?"
"Palmer, if I had hard evidence, I'd speak up. But if I don't have any, people like Kitts will say that I'm lying or hallucinating. Now, that's why that manuscript's in your inside pocket. You're going to seal it, date it, notarize it, and put it in a safety deposit box. If anything happens to me, you can release it to the world. I give you full authority to do anything you want with it."
"And if nothing happens to you?"
"If nothing happens to me, then, when we find what we're looking for, that manuscript will confirm our story. If we find evidence of a double black hole at the galactic center, or some huge artificial construction in Cygnus A, or a message hiding inside pi, this," she tapped him lightly on the chest, "will be my evidence. Then I'll speak out. Meantime, don't lose it."
"I still don't understand," he confessed. "We know there's a mathematical order to the universe, the law of gravity and all that. Now, how is this different? So, there's order inside the digits of pi. So what?"
"No, don't you see? This would be different. This isn't just starting the universe out with some precise mathematical laws that determine physics and chemistry. This is a message. Whoever makes the universe hides messages in transcendental numbers so that they'll be read 15 billion years later when intelligent life finally evolves. I criticized you and Rankin in the time we first met for not understanding this. If God wanted us to know that he existed, why didn't he send us an unambiguous message, I asked. You remember?"
"I remember very well." "You think God is a mathematician?
Something like that. If what we're told is true, if this isn't a wild goose chase, if there's a message hiding in pi and not one of the infinity of other transcendental numbers, there's a lot of ifs." He said, "You're looking for revelation in arithmetic. I know a better way." "Palmer," said Ellie, "this is the only way. This is the only thing that would convince a skeptic. Now imagine we find something. It doesn't have to be tremendously complicated, just something more orderly than could accumulate by chance. That many digits into pi, that's all we need. Then mathematicians all over the world can find exactly the same pattern or message or whatever it proves to be. And then there are no sectarian divisions. Everybody begins reading the same scripture. No one could then argue that the key miracle in the religion was some conjurer's trick, or that later historians had falsified the record, or that it's just hysteria or delusion, or a substitute parent for when we grow up. Everyone could be a believer. Joss said, "You can't be sure you'll find anything. You can hide here and compute till the cows come home, or you can go out and tell your story to the world. Sooner or later, you'll have to choose." "I'm hoping I won't have to choose, Palmer. First the physical evidence, then the public announcements. Otherwise, don't you see how vulnerable we'd be? I don't mean for myself, but..." He shook his head almost imperceptibly. A smile was playing at the corners of his lips. He had detected a certain irony in their circumstances. "Why are you so eager for me to tell my story?" she asked him. Perhaps he took it for a rhetorical question. At any rate, he did not respond, and then she continued, "Don't you think there's been a strange reversal of our positions? I mean, here I am, the bearer of the profound religious experience I can't prove. Really, Palmer, I can barely fathom it. And here you are, the hardened skeptic, trying, more successfully than I ever did, to be kind to the credulous." "Oh, no, Eleanor," he said. "I'm not a skeptic. I'm a believer." "Are you? The story I have to tell isn't exactly about punishment and reward. It's not exactly Advent and rapture. There's not a word in it about Jesus. Part of my message is that we're not central to the purpose of the cosmos. What happened to me makes us all seem very small." "Oh, it does." "But it also makes God very big," he said. She glanced at him for a moment and then rushed on. "You know, as the earth races around the sun, the powers of this world, the religious powers, the secular powers, once pretended that the earth wasn't moving at all. They were in the business of being powerful, or at least pretending to be powerful. And the truth made them feel too small. The truth frightened them. It undetermined their power, so they suppressed it. Those people found the truth dangerous." "You're sure you know what believing me entails?" "I've been searching, Eleanor. After all these years, believe me, I know the truth when I see it. Any faith that admires truth, that strives to know God, must be brave enough to accommodate the universe. I mean the real universe, all those light years, all those worlds. I think of the scope of your universe, the opportunities it affords the Creator, and it takes my breath away. It's much better than bottling him up in one small world. I never liked the idea of Earth as God's green footstool. It was too reassuring, like a children's story, like a tranquilizer. But your universe has room enough and time enough for the kind of God that I believe in. I say you don't need any more proof. There are proofs enough already. Cygnus A and all that are just for the scientists. You think it'll be hard to convince ordinary people that you're telling the truth. I think it'll be as easy as pie. You think your story is too peculiar, too alien, but I've heard it before. I know it well. And I bet you do, too." He closed his eyes, and after a moment he recited. "He dreamed, and behold, a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God ascending and descending on it. Surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not. This is none other but the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven." He had been a little carried away, as if preaching to the multitudes from the pulpit of Great Cathedral, and when he opened his eyes it was with a small, self-deprecatory smile. They walked down a vast avenue.
flanked left and right by enormous whitewashed radio telescopes straining at the sky. And after a moment he spoke in a more conversational tone. Your story has been foretold. It's happened before. Somewhere inside of you, you must have known. None of your details are in the Book of Genesis, of course not. How could they be? The Genesis account was right for the time of Jacob, just as your witness is right for this time, for our time. People are going to believe you, Eleanor. Millions of them all over the world. I know it for certain. She shook her head, and they walked on for another moment in silence before he continued, All right, then. I understand. You take as much time as you have to. But if there's any way to hurry it up, do it. For my sake. We have less than a year to the millennium. Oh, I understand also. Bear with me a few more months, she said. If we haven't found something in Pi by then, I'll consider going public with what happened up there. Before January the 1st, maybe Ada and the others would be willing to speak out also, okay? They walked in silence back toward the Argus administration building. The sprinklers were watering the meager lawn, and they stepped around a puddle that, on this parched earth, seemed alien, out of place. Have you ever been married? He asked. No. I never have. I guess I've been too busy.
Ever been in love?
The question was direct, matter of fact. Halfway, half a dozen times. But, she glanced at the nearest telescope, there was always so much noise and the signal was hard to find. And you? She asked.
Never, he replied flatly.
There was a pause and then he added with a faint smile,
But I have faith.
She decided not to pursue this ambiguity just yet, and they mounted the short flight of stairs to examine the Argus mainframe computer.